General Practice, I applaud you. It's been a difficult week for all of us, I'm sure, but we have risen to the challenge. We have successfully reshaped one of the largest health systems in the world in the space of just 4 days. There's been little help and little direction from the top. We have done this ourselves, practice by practice. In doing so, we have placed our patients, our staff, and ourselves in a much better position to cope with whatever the next few weeks throws at us. So it's Friday, the 20th of March. This is the Hot Topics podcast from MB Medical, and these are lessons for general practice. Welcome back, everyone out there. Thanks for joining us once again on the Hot Topics podcast. My name is Neil Tucker, and today we're going to do another coronavirus special. I think there's only one thing on people's minds. No one really cares if there's another piece of research about avocados helping your blood pressure right now. All that we want to know is what do we need to do over the next few weeks to help us and our patients. Sleepless nights, constant feeling of anxiety and stress. These have become the norm over the last 2 weeks. We've all been adjusting to the new reality, both at work and at home. MB's no different, so we've cancelled all of our spring courses now. But in case you do get the time and the headspace to try and stay up to date with the routine day-to-day general practice, then we have done a pre-recorded version of the spring course. That's going to be up on the website in about a week's time. And we're going to be doing a live streamed course on Saturday, the 25th of April. So Simon Curtis and Sarah Davies will be running us through that. You'll still be able to send in your questions and it's still going to be interactive. So there is still the opportunity to stay as up to date as possible. Also next week, we'll be publishing on the website an on-demand webinar for telephone triage and video consultation skills. It's totally free. We're going to be doing a lot of this over the next few months in practice. I hope that you find it useful. Meanwhile, today we're going to keep you as up to date as we can with the latest developments in coronavirus. And I think the most important thing that I've been trying to do this week is try and learn the lessons from our international colleagues. Because we have a unique opportunity in the UK insofar as we are a few weeks behind some of our international counterparts, particularly Italy and to a certain extent France and a few other European countries. And so there is the opportunity for us to be able to look forward and see what we might expect the UK to look like in the next few weeks. And that can, of course, influence how we prepare and how we manage over the next few months. So I was very lucky to talk to an Italian GP this week who lives in Milan in northern Italy, right in the epicenter of their epidemic. And she had some extremely interesting and useful insights for us. Then I thought it might be helpful to just share what we're doing in our practice, how we're running and how we're trying to maintain some service whilst protecting our patients. We'll spend just a little bit of time talking about the latest scientific developments in COVID. And of course, there's a lot of uncertainty this week around the role of anti-inflammatories, potentially worsening coronavirus, ACE inhibitors and ARBs as well. Lots of suggestion that maybe chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine could be an effective treatment for coronavirus. So we're going to have a little look at that. And then we're going to round up with just a few thoughts on what we can do to help ourselves and preserve ourselves and look after ourselves as well. So I'm very, very grateful to Dr. Nadege Fancy, who took the time to talk to me this week. She's originally from the UK, trained at a UK medical school. Went through hospital training, GP training here, but she's been working in Milan for the last few years. And she paints a picture of what day-to-day life is like now. So she's one of the lucky ones because she goes out to her GP clinic where she works during the week. But the streets are deserted and everyone is on full lockdown. They have to stay in their houses. This is enforced by police on the street and you're only allowed to go out if you are on the way to work in a critical job or you are going to the supermarket. Kids are doing online learning from school. They need their parents to help manage that. The parents themselves are trying to do as much work as they can from home, or of course, you can't work at all. If you go to the supermarket, you have to stand at least 2 meters away from anyone else. There are queues for the supermarket. This is the shape of things to come in the UK over the next few weeks. In her clinic, they're doing everything they can to prevent coronavirus spread to their patients and to themselves. So there is nothing material. There is nothing that is not wipeable in the practice now. There are no papers. There are no magazines on the tables. Their desks are completely clear. Every patient who comes in gets a mask. And after seeing a patient, if there's even the slightest sniff of a possible fever or suggestion of coronavirus, then they thoroughly deep clean their own rooms. We, of course, have all heard the stories about the hospitals in particularly northern Italy being somewhat overwhelmed with the number of cases. And just like we've seen over the last few weeks, their government recommendations on who should come to be reviewed, who should come to get tested, has gradually changed over the last month. And now it's very simple. The message is, unless you think you are dying, do not go to hospital. Do not call the health service. You're going to have to try and manage this at home. They've got a very simple clinical criteria for who merits hospital admission. If you can speak 10 words in a row without gasping, then you're not there yet. You need to stay at home. And yet, amongst all the bleakness of this picture, there are some rays of hope, particularly for primary care. So by this point, 4 weeks into lockdown, people really have got the message about isolation and about only using the stretched resources of their healthcare system if they really, really need to. It sounds just like things are this week. This week, we're all trying to just adjust to the idea of marked social distancing, of staying inside, of the potential for not going out for weeks and weeks, except to just get some shopping, just hoping there's something left in the supermarkets. And the Italians, just like us, in that first week, they just weren't quite there. It takes a while for us to mentally adjust to this, to the idea about isolation, about the seriousness of the situation. But they've done it. They're coping. Their community spirit is better than ever. And this is where we will be in the next few weeks. But fascinatingly, the demand they're seeing in primary care has actually dwindled significantly. It's really dropped off. And she describes, because of social isolation, all those normal coughs and colds, infections that we deal with, all those minor problems like musculoskeletal injuries from just walking around in day-to-day life or doing sports, none of these are happening because they can't go outside, they can't do sports. All of these have disappeared, making general practice in many ways much, much easier. The minority of people now attending general practice, they do tend to be more unwell. There's a very real chance that they do have coronavirus if they've got a fever or a cough, or if they're unwell from something clearly non-COVID-19 related, then there's a good chance that they are really unwell. That's not to say there are not still challenges. And she said it's very interesting to see the rise of other conditions. It is taxing on people's mental health to be in social isolation. They're seeing more problems with mental health. So it's going to be a real exercise in our psychiatric experience to try and help those patients. There may be other problems like people having eye strain from too much screen time or sore backs from too much sitting down. So this will need to be managed, but overall, it sounds like the burden on primary care will be less. Still, there will be challenges. And she said one of the most important messages she could share with us is that our goal will be to try and keep our patients out of hospital at all costs. So hospitals will be overrun. They will be riddled with COVID-19 patients. They're a hotbed for cross-contamination and cross-infection. And the last thing that we want to do is increase the burden on secondary and tertiary care unless it's absolutely necessary. She also said, take heart. The British general practice training is some of the best in the world. So we are in some of the best positions to be able to help our patients and to help our friends and colleagues who work in the hospitals. I think that as demand does dwindle in our day-to-day practice, then that's going to be very positive because it will free us up to try and help out where necessary for us to be able to be used, to be redeployed into areas of need. And I know many of us, for those of us who do have the spare time, who do have the capacity, do want to be able to help wherever we can. So to Dr. Fancy, thank you so much for talking to us this week. I came away from our conversation feeling just that little bit brighter, that bit easier, that persistent pressure, that anxiety that I've had for the last week, just lifting ever so slightly. Now, I thought it would be useful to perhaps share what we've been doing in our practice. And this is not because I think that what we're doing is the gold standard. It's not because I think it's going to be applicable to every practice, but because of the lack of top-down details about how we should be adapting our practice, I thought it's just very useful for us to share to each other what we're doing. See if we could perhaps pick out the best bits and use them to improve our own practices. So when it became clear that we were going to rapidly move to this total triage system, we immediately stopped booking routine appointments. So we already had 4 weeks worth of booked appointments. We sent a text out to all of these patients where possible, saying that those are going to be done over the telephone. Please do not come into the practice. We tried to contact those that we couldn't send out a text to as best as we could. And then many of the clinicians in the practice this week have been doing extra shifts to try and deal with what would have been routine medical care that would previously have been booked 4 weeks in advance right now on the day, leaving the other normal clinicians who would be at work that day to deal with the phone calls for their existing routine appointments. We've been working very hard to take our future routine appointments and try and do them already. So we've been phoning those patients who would be expecting to have their appointment in 3 weeks' time and trying to discuss what the problem is, trying to deal with that right now so that it frees the practice up in the next couple of weeks. Because of course, the problem that we're dealing with is we don't know what's going to happen with our patients. Having talked to our Italian colleague, things may actually get a bit easier, but that's going to be compensated by us going off sick. So as more of us end up self-isolating, whether that's for coronavirus or any other infection, until we're being tested, we're never going to know, then that's going to significantly deplete our workforce. So we want to completely clear the decks to give us that flexibility. And our D-Day at the moment is looking like late in next week. And hopefully that's going to be soon enough before we start dropping like flies and COVID numbers really start to rise. After that, the plan is to have just two lists each day. One will be a traditional duty doctor's list for more urgent problems. The second will be for what would have been a routine appointment. Those will be telephone calls and we'll try and get those done on the day. We'll nominate a lead clinician for the day. They'll probably have to have the best overview of the duty doctor list. And then the other clinicians will just be picking off whatever seems to be the most important issues at the time. And we're just going to be working flexibly. It's going to be a fluid process. We're going to evolve the system as it becomes apparent what works and what doesn't work. And I think that's what we're going to have to do. We're just going to have to keep it open, learn from our experiences on a daily basis, and evolve as fast as we can. Of course, it became very quickly apparent at the start of the week that 111 services were overrun and there was no possibility that patients who had possible COVID-19 would be assessed by them unless they were really unwell, and that we would have to end up seeing those patients. So we've been triaging people into one of four categories. So there are the red patients. These have proven COVID-19. They need to come nowhere near the practice. They need to be flagged up to secondary care. There's the amber patients. So these are patients with possible COVID-19. But in reality, this means basically anyone with a fever, any upper respiratory tract problems, even someone who would be unwell from a bit of diarrhea or perhaps a UTI, they get triaged as amber. They're treated as high-risk patients. They get told to inform reception when they come in that they are an amber patient, and then they get taken straight to our isolation room. They are given a mask, and then one of the clinicians will go in and assess them with all of our fantastic PPE kit that we have, remembering to decontaminate the room thoroughly ourselves afterwards. So wiping down any equipment we use, the computer, the tables, the chairs, the door handles, the beds or couches, disposing of the PPE kit in a clean fashion, and then decontaminating yourself afterwards as well. All this takes time, so we have to be able to give ourselves more time, and we have to work in the most flexible way we can at the moment. And personally, I think the idea about having any timed appointments in the coming weeks would be a mistake. It's just going to be extraordinarily stressful. We need to build in as much flexibility to our systems as we can. Then we have green patients. So green patients are low COVID risk. They've got no current symptoms, no exposure to contacts. They've not been self-isolating. And these go to a different part of the practice. We work in a building that's several hundred years old. It's far from ideal for modern general practice. There's many floors, there's lots of different little rooms, there's loads of waiting rooms. It's difficult to see patients who are unable to get up the stairs. There's lots and lots of problems. But I have to say, in the context of a pandemic, having lots of different waiting rooms where you can put people in different risk categories is very, very helpful. So it's made it easier for us to segregate patients to try and keep them safe. So the greens go in a separate waiting room, and then we have a blue category. These are our very high risk patients, the immunosuppressed, those on cancer medications, transplants, end stage renal failure, these kind of patients in whom we really don't want to run any risk of cross contamination. And of course, the goal is to just have as few people in the practice as possible to try and manage as much over the phone as we can. And that's not going to be possible for everyone. We are going to still need to see people. We have to mitigate the risk of them becoming infected when they reach our practice. But I've been surprised by how much we've been able to deal on the phone. And I've also been pleasantly surprised about the patients as well. Our patients, I think, really have got the seriousness of the situation. They were very appreciative that we were still working. They understood the rationale for why we were working in the way that we are right now, and they wanted to try and help us with that. So whilst I don't think any of us would necessarily agree that this is the best way we can practice medicine, it is possible to practice pretty safe, pragmatic medicine, doing what we're doing. And now is the time for us to practice, to upskill. So in the next few weeks, so that this becomes second nature and can be really effective. Locally, they are setting up a coronavirus hub. I'm imagining this is going to happen in every area around the country. So what is now our amber patients, hopefully in the next week or two, will all be going to the coronavirus hub, further minimizing the risk in practices. Of course, these hubs are going to need to be staffed, and that's going to be a mixture of clinicians. We're going to need someone from all different areas. We're going to need practice nurses. We're going to need paramedics. We're going to need pharmacists and physician associates. We're going to need GPs. We're going to need receptionists. And not all of us will be able to do this for various different reasons. And that's okay too. We've still got a role to play. One of my colleagues on the Hot Topics course said first day of lockdown and he diagnosed two cancers. Cancer doesn't give a crap about coronavirus, does it? These things are going to keep on coming. We have to be able to deal with it. We've been using the text system a lot. So we've been texting out instructions for our amber, green and blue patients. And also we've been exploring the use of those for things like fitness to work notes. So you can attach a fitness to work note to a text message, or you can email it to a patient, and it doesn't necessarily need a signature. This is going to be really, really useful to reduce unnecessary footfall through the practice. So I think technology can be really, really helpful for us over the coming weeks. But I'm mindful about a very sensible comment I saw and some guidance put together by Tricia Greenhowl of evidence-based medicine fame. I'm sorry, Tricia, I've got your book, but apologies if I pronounce your name wrong. So she's helped to put together some guidance on video consulting, but was very clear to point out, think very carefully whether you need to use video calls in preference to just the simple telephone. And that's the same with other new technologies. Let's utilize them where they may be helpful, but let's not feel obliged to try and force them into our practice. We've got enough to deal with at the moment. Sometimes traditional means are the best and safest way. So that's a lot of talking already. Let's do a quick summary of the latest developments in our understanding about coronavirus throughout the week then. Let's start with testing. So testing, of course, is a huge issue for us. The lack of our ability to test is so frustrating. And there's a lot of anger that healthcare professionals are not being tested. In my wife's practice, they've got four GPs off at the moment, all having to self-isolate because of some feverish illness. And a lot of it doesn't sound like coronavirus. They do want to be back at work. And of course, a test would allow them to know what's going on and return if they could. But the sad reality is there are just not the resources. So they do not have the number of test kits. They do not have the reagents. They do not have the staff to be able to process it at the level, the capacity that's required at the moment. Locally to me yesterday, they were requesting that we in primary care sent back our viral swabs to the hospital because they needed them so badly. This is the level of resources that we're having to deal with. So it's not that your government, your hospitals, your CCGs don't want to allow testing of healthcare professionals. It's just that they can't. And I think this is a wake-up call to us about how lucky we are with some of the resources that we've got when times are good, but also how thinly those resources are stretched and how easy it is for them to break. But how good are the tests? And this remains uncertain. So there is still no published data on how accurate these tests are. What is the sensitivity in symptomatic cases? And I've heard lots of figures bandied around. Officials are often saying that the sensitivity of PCR is very good. I've then heard people say that it's about 70 or 80%, and I'm not quite sure where that's come from. But what we can say is that the nose and throat swabs that are taken for PCR are not always perfect. So the sensitivity isn't perfect. You can get false negatives. We know that sputum samples, if people are having a productive cough, are more accurate and less likely to give a false negative. So perhaps even if we do have much better access to tests, then we can't be completely reassured by the results either way. Although I think it's a reasonable argument to say that something is better than nothing. How is this going to affect pregnant women? That's a common question. And we still feel that it seems to be a relatively safe infection in pregnant women. There seems to be no vertical transmission. But of course, this is a new infection. There's limited data. And so pregnant women for now continue to be considered in a high risk category. There was fascinating psychology this week as two stories about common medications seemed to cause panic throughout the global population, spread like wildfire through social media. I was at work doing an extra shift on Tuesday morning and was surprised to find that my younger brother, who has no medical knowledge whatsoever, WhatsApping me about four patients in Cork in Ireland who had died and they thought it was because of ibuprofen use exacerbating their coronavirus. And it turned out that this was one of several fake news social media stories about ibuprofen. And there were a number of others which were geared towards different countries that were shared millions of times within hours. It was absolutely incredible. Presumably, some people may have been worried that they were already taking ibuprofen for minor illnesses. I guess some others were just annoyed that they'd been stockpiling Nurofen and spent £10 per box. Apparently, the origin of this was a French doctor who had been working with coronavirus and had just flagged up that anti-inflammatories can potentially increase complication rates in a number of infections. And then the French health minister had warned the population about this, and then things sort of escalated from there. The actual concept is not without merit, although it's important to point out that there is no data at the moment that COVID-19 outcomes are worsened by the use of anti-inflammatories. But there are a number of studies into other infections, including respiratory tract infections, urinary tract infections. Someone recently reminded me, of course, of chickenpox as well, all of which have potentially some serious complications linked to anti-inflammatories. Maybe not that common, maybe not that frequent, but it was enough that the UK government response, which now provides us with some clarity, also then has gone on to say, why don't people use paracetamol in preference and then only ibuprofen if they need it? Meanwhile, we are going to look into this and try and find a more robust answer. They also clarify that if people are already on anti-inflammatories, they should continue with them, assuming that there's a sound rationale for that prescription. ACE inhibitors and ARBs were also subject of speculation. And this originated from the fact that it's known that COVID-19 is enabled to enter the body by piggybacking off of ACE2 in our sort of angiotensin pathway, and that these ACE2 receptors are increased in people who take ACE inhibitors and ARBs. And so then they made this link that perhaps people on these medications may have worse outcomes. Again, there's no data to suggest this. And actually, around the world, very rapidly, lots of international bodies, including things like the European Society of Cardiology, were very quick to point out that there was no data to support this claim. And indeed, they didn't feel that the scientific basis in itself was sound. The advice was quite clear. People should not stop their ACE inhibitors and ARBs. The last thing we need is increased rates of stroke, MI, and heart failure from people stopping their treatments. Interestingly, though, there is an American called Anthony Fauci, who is the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the US. And he's done some very, very interesting interviews with the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine and with JAMA. And he was saying that there does seem to be some link between worse outcomes and people with hypertension, enough that he said that we should be looking into it in more detail. But there was no suggestion that people should be moderating their treatment with ACEs or ARBs in any way. The big question that's popped up in the last few days is about chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. And it's been suggested that this could be an effective treatment for coronavirus. So much so that I've seen some doctors on some of the medical forums posting about the potential doses that one might prescribe. I think this is very, very premature. The Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford has been doing some very, very good reviews of the data that we do have and what we do know about a range of issues around coronavirus. And one of their pages is summarizing the number of treatment trials that are currently being undertaken for COVID-19. And hydroxychloroquine is on the list. It is known to have some efficacy in HIV. It has been shown to have some efficacy in vitro for COVID-19. But that is very different from having proven efficacy in the real world in actual humans. What we need, much stronger data before anyone can start thinking about using this as a treatment or prophylactic agent. In the New England Journal of Medicine this week, they published a paper on the use of lopinavir and ritonavir. These are two drugs I am not very familiar with, but had been speculated to be of benefit in treating severe coronavirus infection. And the results of the study in their placebo-controlled trial showed that it didn't make a significant difference. So we need to be very careful before we start jumping on the bandwagon about the next possible magic cure. But I am encouraged that there are a number of very good, well-designed trials that are currently underway. And indeed, even locally to us, they've set up a randomized controlled trial for severe coronavirus patients, comparing the roles of steroids, antivirals, and I think it was interferon. So hopefully it won't be long before we know if there's other good options beyond simply supportive therapy. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was just a thought for us to be mindful about the pressures that we're under at the moment and just to look after ourselves as best as we can. As we keep on hearing, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And we've all been working really hard over the last couple of weeks to try and prepare ourselves as best as we can. And so we're tired, we're a little frayed at the edges. It's easy to be short and snappy. So I think let's just try and take a moment to remind ourselves. Let's be kind to ourselves. Don't be hard on yourself. We're making lots of difficult decisions at the moment. Not all of them will be right. That's okay. These are unprecedented times. We're doing the best we can with the resources that we've got. Be kind to others. They're in the same boat as you are. They're feeling all the same things. let's help each other out as much as we can. Some of our biggest strengths are in our teams and our camaraderie. Take some time for yourself. Do something that you enjoy. That might be reading a book, doing some yoga, playing computer games, whatever it is, just give yourself a bit of a mental break. Remember that you can't do everything. And over the next few weeks, as things escalate, we may be asked to do more and more, and we can help out as much as we can. But remember to keep some time for yourself. Eat, drink, sleep when you can. Remember to try and maintain those social contacts. We did a group WhatsApp call with my wife's family the other day, which was really fun, and we're going to have to get used to using these kind of technologies more. On the matter of phones and technology, social media can be a powerful tool for disseminating information, but it is also potentially a rabbit hole within which you can get buried. So if it starts stressing you out like it did me last week, then just back off and keep it simple. So when it's feeling all a bit overwhelming, let's just pause. Take a breath. Let's remind ourselves what we've already achieved. In just 1 week, we have reshaped general practice into a powerful weapon against coronavirus. We are simultaneously the front line and the last bastion. We are the place where people with nowhere else to go can come. Yes, our armory is small, but the weapons are strong. Be that the respirator in the hospital, the telephone call that helps the patient without bringing them to the practice, or just self-isolation when we don't feel well to protect our colleagues, our friends, and our neighbours. I know some of you out there already have coronavirus. I know some of you are self-isolating because you just don't know, but you desperately want to help. Don't worry, your time to shine will come. There is hope that things in primary care may not be as bad as our anxieties are driving us to believe at the moment. But this is no time for complacency. We will have to support our friends and colleagues working in the hospitals around the country. We need to support our patients to try and keep them out of those hospitals as best as we can. We may need to step into roles that we are unfamiliar with, but I know that we can do this because we've already shown how adaptable we are. So take heart, keep safe, and we will do our best to try and keep sharing the best information that's available to us so that we can do the best that we possibly can for the nation. All being well, we'll see you next week. Look after yourselves.